This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Barbara Ransby. And the funny story is I first discovered Barbara Ransby because of her book, Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement, which I've been dying to interview her about. But that's a book she wrote a few years back. But before we can even get to that, up popped a new book called Aslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. Barbara Ransby is professor in the Department of African American Studies, Gender and Women's Studies and History, director of the Gender and Women's Studies Program, University of Illinois in Chicago, as well as a new program, Social Justice Initiative.
Exactly.
And welcome. Good to meet you. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So my producer shows me this book. She said, do you want to do a book, an interview on this book, Aslanda? I went, Aslanda?
Sounds like a place.
It does a place. I haven't been to yet. Uh-huh. But Aslanda Robeson, again, one of the things I said as soon as I saw it was, who knew?
Who knew? Yeah, she, I mean, and, you know, I, like everyone else, was introduced to her through her larger-than-life husband, Paul Robeson.
Right.
I was doing research many years ago at the Schomburg Library in New York and was looking through the Robeson collection, and I got distracted by some of her papers that were there. And what a life. I mean, I was really kind of seduced by her story. It was so fascinating and so interesting. I wrote a short article about her many years ago when I was still a student. And then I thought, you know, she had remained on my mind. I thought about her over the years, and I wondered, you know, who was going to write that biography and really assumed that it would have been done in the intervening years. And when it had not been, I decided to take up the task. And it was quite a journey.
I mean, because you took the journey with Ella Baker.
Yes.
I mean, there's a reason you're doing these journeys around black women, I would say black women who were revolutionary leaders, not just the icons people want to put out there, but the revolutionary leaders of the world.
Right. Well, I see them as a part of a radical tradition. They were supportive of revolutionary movements, but they themselves didn't orchestrate revolutions, let's say. But mm-hmm. But both of them were really on the precipice of history in really important ways. And I see it as a kind of a reclamation project, you know, that a recuperative project to find their stories, to tell their stories to this generation of students and to activists. But it's really more than the singular stories, because my approach to biography is one of really trying to use a single life to look at some larger issues, traditions, moments in time. And when we look at the civil rights movement, for example, I know we're talking about Aslanda not Ella Baker, but it's you know, it's a comparable example. When we look at it through Ella Baker's lens, it looks different. We see a grassroots tradition. We see and hear the voices of a whole number of people who don't necessarily appear when you only focus on the national stage
right.
and on the most prominent leaders. And similarly with Essie Robeson, who was quite an internationalist at a time when black women lived very circumscribed lives. And we see the world different traveling with her.
No, we do. I mean, I was in awe of all the people she met and the places she'd been and what she accomplished and because she was as accomplished as Paul Robeson was.
I think so. She was very differently. And they were very much a team. I mean, it was a complicated relationship, but it was a 44-year partnership. But she was also a fiercely independent person and traveled the world with him, but also traveled to many places without him, including to sub-Saharan Africa on three occasions, two of those occasions for extended periods. And those were really transformative journeys for her, times where she really saw the world from a different vantage point and came back energized and committed and clear about her own political voice in ways that she had not been before.
She comes out of a world of reconstruction through her father and her mother and
mm-hmm. her grandfather. Her grandfather, Francis Lewis Cardoza, is a Reconstruction-era politician from South Carolina. And it's appropriate that you say through her mother because her mother kept the story of her grandfather alive.
Right.
You know, he died when Essie Robeson was quite young, but Essie Cardoza Good Robeson. But her mother kept that story alive, and it was a story of resistance. It was a story of the importance of dignity to this family. It was a story of perseverance. And in one of her publications, Essie Robeson says, she says, you know, I've always been a fighter. My grandfather went to jail for his beliefs. And so, you know, I've been determined never to let anyone push me around. And that was, you know,
from
that
childhood
was her,
on.
From childhood on, she has a run in with a little boy that calls her the N-word. And, you know, she doesn't shrink and she doesn't cry. She basically teaches him a lesson.
Even before she knew what the word meant.
That's
right. She knew it wasn't good.
She knew it wasn't good. When she found out she had been insulted, right. She proceeded to pummel the little fellow.
When she made her decisions that she was either going to be her own person or be one of those little girly girls, and she decided against the girly girl persona.
Exactly. She wanted to be respected.
And she did from the beginning.
Yeah.
Now, her mother was also, I mean, I was really interested in the early parts of the story, mm-hmm. just little pieces about her mom that's really kind of stuck out to me. The fact that her mom was friends with Hubert Harrison.
Exactly. Well, her mother's story, even before Hubert Harrison and the Liberty Leagues, her mother comes from privilege, relative privilege, but her husband dies when her children are still quite young, and so she's raising three children on her own in the early 1900s. So that was difficult, and she toughened up quite a bit just in terms of her personal journey. But in Harlem in the 19-teens, she befriends Hubert Harrison, Pan-Africanist socialist, radical thinker, very advanced in his views on women's rights and sexuality. So she supports the Liberty League and Liberty League's publication. And that's, you know, kind of her political launching pad, if you will. And Aslanda is exposed to that early on.
I mean, because those things, just like this book about Aslanda and the book that was really written a few years back about Hubert Harrison, these are people who are lost in some ways to history. But through their movements, at the moment they were doing things, when she was doing things throughout her history, it was profound. She was pushing change. She was somebody who really helped create change, and so that those are the cogs in our history that we have lost that are so important kind of to bring up, which is what you're doing here.
Yeah, well, I'm trying. You know, her story is interesting on a number of levels. It's interesting in terms of a black radical tradition that's internationalist. You know, I think unfortunately a lot of times black American history is talked about in either very parochial terms. Or, you know, now that we have a black president, you know, sort of we think of official, you know, heads of state and black diplomats representing the United States in the world, as opposed to a different kind of a much more progressive and much more grassroots internationalist tradition. And so Aslanda is a part of a black internationalist tradition at a time when it was very difficult. I mean, travel was difficult. Communication was difficult. She lived through the McCarthy era, which, you know, made it all the more difficult. And she, of course, had her passport taken and was, you know, confined to the United States. But so that internationalist tradition is, I think, important to recapture and retell. But also the role of women, which often gets buried, lost, you know, relegated to the margins. I mean, even in this day and age where we do have women in many positions of influence and power and all that, we still have a very segregated and male-centered historiography.
You think so?
I do.
I'm just kidding.
I do. Yes. I think we both do.
What you described, though, I mean, and again, is I think the importance of this is that she was an African-American leader, but she was a feminist leader. I mean, she stood up for women's rights from the beginning. As you write in the book, she had her own contradictions around women.
Yes.
At least personally at times.
Yes.
But fundamentally, she was involved in women's rights throughout the globe, especially women's rights when it came to the quote-unquote colored world of the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. And she did. She wrote in a few places things that were a little bit unkind to, you know, she said, you know, well, some women, they're involved in such frivolous things and I'm so impatient with them and they can cause their own problems. And so she said that in a very dismissive way. But really, in the final analysis, and more often than not, I mean, she was somebody who really, in an unwavering way, promoted women's leadership. She was at the founding convention of the United Nations in 1945 in the wake of World War II. And she wrote about women's gatherings at the founding convention and talked about the importance in this new phase of history that was coming, that women played a leadership role because, of course, men had run the world before that, right, and had not done such a good job. She also worked with a number of organizations. She worked with a group called the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, and my colleague Eric McDuffie has written a wonderful book on that organization. They exposed all kinds of discrimination that black women faced, but they also expressed solidarity with South African women, sent letters, protested in Washington, and so forth. And she was joined in that organization by people like Bea Richardson, for example, who is a well-known actor. She was the mother in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. She was Sidney Poitier's mother. That's
right,
what people know her for. But she was also very much a political person. But Islanda worked in that organization. She worked with a woman named Claudia Jones, who was a black communist leader who had been exiled from the United States. She worked with Claudia Jones in London on an organization called the All African Women's Freedom Movement, which was really trying to unite black women in the African diaspora.
And I think that we'll jump into this in a little bit, but the communist movement that she was part of, and a lot of African Americans were part of. I mean, it spoke to, from the teens through the 40s and 50s especially, it spoke to a lot of oppressed groups. It spoke to a lot of black folks in America. It spoke to Jews in America. It spoke to lots of people who were at the bottom.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, she said repeatedly that she was not a member of the Communist Party. So,
as did he.
And so we take them at their word. I believe that they were telling the truth. But they were supporters of a communist movement, and they traveled to the Soviet Union. They put their son in school there. And I think it's your question is framed in the right way, I think, which is to say that that was not extremely unusual, especially in the 30s. There were many, many people in this country who were looking around them at the Great Depression and the ravages that it had wrought for, you know, poor and working class people. And socialism didn't look so bad. And people were very curious about what was happening in the Soviet Union. So the Robesons did spend time there. But the other thing, you know, I think a lot of the discussions of the Robesons and their international politics has focused on kind of Cold War East versus West. But the North versus South, you know, the divide between North and South, that is the global South, the colonized world, is really an important one in terms of understanding Islanda Robeson's global politics, including her support for the Soviet Union, because she saw it as an ally of the anti-colonial movement, which it was.
I mean, she, parts of that, I'm kind of jumping out of the chronological mind I had to start with. That's fine.
Sorry.
No. I'd rather do this. This is fine. Is that, I mean, this is how instrumental she was. You can tell these stories. I mean, she would go to the Soviet Union, and I forget the man's name, but he was leader of the Communist Party in Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm. And she was pushing the Soviet Union to stand up and take certain positions, which they ultimately did in many ways, to stand up for the rights of Africans and communities of color around the world. That was pretty amazing.
Right. I don't want to overstate her influence there. I mean, she was there for, she and Paul were both there for medical treatment, and that you're referring to a series of conversations followed up by letters in which she really tried to use, you know, her relationship, her personal relationship with Soviet leaders and the ear of folks that she was in touch with in the Soviet Union to speak out about the complex political landscape of Africa in that period. And this is the period of the late 50s, early 60s. And she, you know, she really researched and spent a lot of time herself coming to terms with and coming to an understanding of all the forces on the ground. And that was an interesting learning experience for me, because I'm not an Africanist in terms of my scholarship, and I had forgotten how many different factions, how many freedom movements that were contesting one another, how
right.
many petitions before the United Nations about territory status versus complete independence. And, you know, it was a real minefield of various stages of decolonization. And she immersed herself in that, and she had very, very clear views about what would be the most progressive outcome at each stage of that struggle.
And she was right in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things she was right about is Lily Golden, who is someone who is a black Russian, someone who lived in the Soviet Union many years, and the Robesons met her when they were there. Her father had migrated there. Talked about Islanda Robeson as one of the early people who spoke out against neocolonialism, that is, the fear that some of the emergent leaders in Africa were going to ultimately betray the goal of decolonization, the goal of independence and African freedom. And some of them, of course, did. So she saw that.
She was
fearful.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's go way back. Let's go back to World War One, off to Harlem, the beginning of the Renaissance, the Harlem Renaissance, this incredible world that you paint, that she was part of. and her falling in love with this man she meets on the street.
Yeah, and his reputation preceded him in some ways, but they did. They met on the streets of Harlem, 1919, and she considered herself someone who was not easily smitten, or you know, she was tough, she was savvy, and she was not going to be swept off her feet. But she met Paul Robeson, and like many people who met Paul Robeson, he was pretty amazing. And she couldn't get him out of her mind, and she really you know, became quite taken with him and quite interested in having a relationship with him, and the feeling was mutual. I mean, I think some things that have, you know, been written about their early relationship, I think, don't fully capture the passion that they had for one another. I mean, they wrote love letters, and I suppose people can make up things or exaggerate, but these seem to me to be really genuine love letters. That, you know, Paul pledging his lifelong, you know, lifelong heart to her, and her, you know, talking about how happy she was to be with him. And so they really built, they were building his career. They were building a life together. They were seeing the world, and it was a very exciting time. Harlem was a very important beginning point for them, that community of creative artists and activists. They were not political at that time, really, but it was a time of enormous stimulation and excitement. And I think it was, you know, kind of predictable that a very creative partnership like theirs was born there.
In Harlem, well, two things come to mind as you're describing this and as it goes to the book. A, Harlem was their life. Mm-hmm. They loved Harlem. Mm-hmm. Wherever they went, they wanted to get back to Harlem.
Yeah.
There was something, that place, you can describe that vibrancy as well. And also their relationship, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, I mean, that was very intense and volatile and loyal at some levels, deeply loyal, but was ended up being one of the first open marriages that people could put their hands around. They were really, that was fascinating.
Yeah, well, you know, Harlem was, you say, you know, the vibrancy of Harlem. I think it was a very vibrant atmosphere for them. And, you know, people were also going and coming. And so I think it was when Eslanda really immersed herself in the culture in Harlem and in New York City at that time, she began to see glimpses of a larger world through the Black diaspora that was gathered in Harlem, because people were from the Caribbean. People were coming through from Africa. In fact, a man named Kojo Tuvalu Haunu was someone who she met in Harlem in 1924, who really piqued her interest in Africa and began to make her think about the possibilities of going there. So Harlem was what it is and where it is, and it was a lively and dynamic place, but it was also a window to a larger world for the Robesons and many others.
I mean, it was a place that, yeah, I mean, it did. The way you described it, the way people describe it, it's a place that exploded in many ways. I mean, there was regular life going on and poverty and working people all around, but there was this intelligentsia, artistic and political, that was a force that really gave Harlem its soul, part of its soul.
Part of its soul, yeah.
Part of its soul.
And I think the thing I found interesting about Essie, she had a couple of friends, a woman named Hattie Bowling and a woman named Minnie Sumner, who weren't actually artists or intellectuals in the sense that we think of it. And these became people who were her lifelong friends. So there were also just the regular folk of Harlem who lived there, who loved the community, who were loyal to each other. And that became a part of what Harlem meant to Essie as well.
I love that every time you talk about their travels and her travels, how desperately at some point she just wanted to get back.
Mm. Yeah, it was an anchor for her.
When living in the Soviet Union, and Paul Jr. was going to school in the Soviet Union, she wanted him to go back to, as she put it, be with other Negro children, to kind of find it, not to be stuck in this other place and
right.
be part of that
and
world.
And he went to school there, and of course they were back and forth a lot, and they were based at that time in London from 1928 to 1939. But it was there was a real homecoming when they returned to Harlem.
I noticed in your book you have some little portion. Would you like to share something just to read that you think is really kind of critical, and we can jump off from that, whatever that happens to be,
okay,
just to hear your words in print?
Hear my words in print.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, we were talking about the travel. So Eslanda's first trip to sub-Saharan Africa in 1936 really changed her worldview enormously. And she took that trip with her young 8-year-old son in tow. It was an arduous journey. It was an uncertain journey because she didn't have all her paperwork in place before she left from London. But it was a very emotional trip. And I think it was a very introspective time for her. What was the work that she was going to do with her life, with her talent and so forth? And she wrote extensively about this trip in her diary. And later this was published in something called African Journey. But there was at the beginning of the trip, she wrote as she was off the coast of Senegal. And this is what she wrote. She wrote in her diary, "It is a gray and heavy thought that between 1666 and 1800, more than 5.5 million of kidnapped Africans, my ancestors, began the dreadful journey across the Atlantic from this very stretch of coast to be sold as slaves in the New World. No wonder the sea and the sky and the very air of this whole area seems sinister to me." So that trip to Africa was very much about, in her mind, reclaiming a part of her past that she had felt alienated from, and coming to terms with the legacy of slavery, coming to terms with the reality of colonialism. And it was a launching pad for her. Now, I say that because she had had an intellectual connection to Africa before that. She was studying at the London School of Economics, which is where Jomo Kenyatta, for example, the future leader of independent Kenya, was one of her classmates.
Well, they met.
And she introduced him to Paul Robeson. She was studying with Bronislaw Malinowski, famous anthropologist. So she was studying Africa. She was reading about Africa. And in fact, Jomo Kenyatta was someone who told her a different story, a different narrative about the African continent, and really enticed her to want to go there. But that was a cerebral experience. She wanted to have the visceral experience and the visual experience of going to the continent for herself. And so that's what she wrote when that journey began.
I mean, we're talking, we're talking about a 41, I guess, at that point, year old black woman, child in tow, Paul Robeson Jr.
Yeah.
Going to colonial dominated Africa in conditions that Westerners were not used to living,
mm-hmm.
even in the better conditions of the leaders of the villages that she met,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and how that affected her,
mm-hmm.
and how her meetings with and even confrontations with the colonialists themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a trip which, like her life, had a lot of contradictions. I mean, she was in some ways a woman of privilege. When she went in 1936, her husband was an international star in many ways. She could have had a much more comfortable vacation if that's what she was searching for. But she wasn't searching for that, and she was really interested in troubling the waters, including the waters of her own privilege, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she goes to South Africa first. She visits some of the mines outside Johannesburg. She visits the townships, people living under very, very difficult and want conditions. She visits a conference, a very important conference, an all-African conference that was held in South Africa in a place called Bloemfontein in Orange Free State in 1936. And there she meets some of the leaders of the South African freedom struggle, future leaders of the African National Congress, A.B. Zuma, Z.K. Matthews. I mean, these are legendary figures in the South African.
Pre-Mandelian leaders of the ANC.
Right. And people who overlapped, with the early Mandela generation, went to jail for their beliefs and so forth. She stayed with them. She went to this conference with them. She really immersed herself in observing not only the suffering under colonialism, but the resistance that was afoot as well. And then they go on and spend 3 months in Uganda. Again, her son is with her. She's doing her anthropological research in a village called Kabarole in Uganda. And you mentioned she's meeting some of the architects and managers of colonialism. So because she was a distinguished guest, an American, not qualifying her as an African American, I think her light skin made her a little ambiguous in certain circles. So sometimes,
some of those folks, yes.
Yeah, some folks didn't quite know what to make of her.
Some was a little darker.
He was darker. He was darker. But she ends up being a guest of the British governor of the territory of Uganda before she leaves. And she, again, writes in her diary, she is in turmoil about this. She really felt like, why am I here? Here I'm in colonial Africa. I'm around all these, white colonial rulers. But she, she accepted the invitation. She spoke truth to power during a dinner that she was invited to, really telling them some of her thoughts about colonialism. And then she left. But she left in some ways a changed person, having seen all that she saw during that trip.
A very changed person. I think that I'm just so, I was really just blown away by her fearlessness.
Mm.
And taking on these journeys, the journey she took after that to Central America, also going back to Africa and parts of the continent. I mean, she didn't stop these kind of journeys. She's,
right.
You know?
She went all over. I mean, in some ways, her internationalist views, her worldview began with her interest in Africa, but it certainly didn't end there. She never traveled to India, but she had a deep interest in the Indian freedom movement, close ties with the Nehru and Pandit families of India, very
she
close ties.
She interviewed Gandhi very early on?
She interviews Gandhi in 1931. That begins her curiosity about India. So she felt very close to that freedom movement. In fact, the daughters of Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit, who was the first woman chair of the UN General Assembly, was the sister of Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, who was the first prime minister of India. Her daughters actually spent time at the Robeson home when they were college students, and their mother was actually in prison in India for her independence activity. So that reflects some of the closeness. She also spent, Aslanda visited the Caribbean. The West Indian Federation was kind of a post-colonial experiment as a transition from colonialism in the late 1950s. And she went there for a very important meeting. She spoke publicly. This was in Trinidad. The meeting was held. But she was close friends with Chetty Jagan, who became leader of independent Guyana, and his wife, Janet Jagan. So some of the key figures of the independence movement, the what many people call the post-Bandung. Bandung was a conference in 1955 that kind of attempted to launch a non-aligned movement during the Cold War. These were people that she knew well. She knew their stories. She supported their struggles. So it was quite an expansive view of her political identity and her political family.
She's Zelig-like.
Yes. Yes, she was everywhere. She was, and she was in... she was in China a couple months after Mao's revolution in 1949, 1950. She was on the front lines of the Spanish Civil War with Paul in 1938. I mean, we're jumping around in terms of the decades, but historic events, and she was a witness participant in those events, founding of the United Nations.
So we're going to come back to all that. We're talking right now to Dr. Barbara Ransby. Her latest work is Aslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. We'll be right back.
This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. We'll return to this archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show after this very short break. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Now back to our segment.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, still with Dr. Barbara Ransby. Her latest book, Aslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. Of course, as we said earlier, Barbara Ransby is a professor in the Department of African-American Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and History, and director of the Gender and Women's Studies Program at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and is a creator of the Social Justice Initiative there as well, which I'm sure we'll hear more about in the coming months and years. And she is the award-winning author of the award-winning book, Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement. One of the things that's also kind of striking about her is that, about Aslanda Robeson, is the people she met. We've talked about a few of them. And the friendship she kept for life. I mean, she really worked. People often say you have to work at friendships. She worked at keeping these things alive, from the Nehru family to Jagan to Emma Goldman for a long time. I mean, just incredible people that she just touched and were touched by her.
Yes, yes, yes. She did. And, you know, sometimes they weren't all smooth relationships. I mean, the world was changing, and these were people who were deeply, deeply passionate about what they believed. And so there were disagreements, and there were periods of silence. But she maintained correspondence with such a wide, wide array of people over so many years. I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, one of the things that struck me about her trips to Africa, she met people when she was there and she kept in touch with them. Even people she disagreed with, there were letters. And this was her way of kind of getting reconnaissance about what was happening on the ground, particularly in South Africa during some very volatile decades. But she was writing to Nehru and to his sister. She was corresponding with Shirley Graham Du Bois, who was the wife of course, the great intellectual and author W.B. Du Bois, as they traveled around the world, people she met in China. So she corresponded and kept in touch. And as there were conferences and reasons that some of the people in her orbit were moving around the planet, and sometimes they would overlap in London or Soviet Union. It was a very, I mean, the title of the book, The Large and Unconventional Life, and it was a very large life.
And let's talk about one piece, the largeness I want to talk about, and the unconventionality I want to talk about here. Start with that. Is their relationship, their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Robeson had a zest for women.
That's a way to put it. Well, he was a very attractive man. He was also very charismatic and all of this. And so, yeah, I mean, he had a number of extramarital relationships. Essie may have had some, too. She didn't say emphatically and explicitly that, you know, this was a romantic relationship or I had an intimate relationship with this person. So I don't, you know, I
don't
speculate.
Know.
We don't know. But we know that Paul did. And we know that at a certain point after they flirted with the idea of divorce, they settled into what was, you know, by contemporary standards and terms, an open marriage. Now, because of sexism and celebrity, in a way, it was much more open for Paul than for Essie.
Right.
But I don't think, you know, I think it's important for me to also suggest that and make it clear that I don't think she was a victim. I don't think she was accepting
right.
of something that she felt was a major compromise. I mean, it wasn't ideal, but she felt that that relationship enabled her to do the work she wanted to do in the world. And she believed in Paul's art and she believed in the politics that they shared. And so the partnership increasingly was based on those things.
And the other part of her life was as a writer. And we need to talk about that. I mean, she was prolific.
She writes a lot. Now, sadly, much of her writing has never been published. Some of her writing projects were never completed because of a variety of things, illness, McCarthy tyranny, money, etc. But, yeah, she wrote plays. She wrote novels. She was a journalist, and her work that was most widely seen by a public audience was her journalism. She covered the United Nations for over a decade and wrote about issues from Korea to Algeria to Cameroon, just with enormous acuity and depth. So that's the writing that is most widely known. She co-authored a book with Pearl Buck.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's
yeah. Called American Argument, and indeed it was. I mean, it was them, the two women, two very formidable women of strong opinions, worldly women, who disagreed on many things and debated those disagreements in the pages of American Argument. She also wrote a biography of Paul in 1930, and then her book African Journey in 1945.
And I think that the Pearl S. Buck book,
yeah,
even that whole idea of these two deep thinkers, one black woman, one white woman, writing this book together about what they didn't agree on and their views of the world.
Yeah.
It's pretty astounding.
Yeah, and I think the book project evolved out of some conversations and out of Islanda's admiration for Paul Buck's publications on China. I mean, she's a world-renowned China scholar who had lived there. And this book evolved into a conversation between the two of them. And so they go back and forth around a whole range of issues from sex and monogamy to the Soviet Union, which they did disagree on quite a bit, to what it means to be an intellectual, to class privilege, to the role of women. So there was really a free-flowing conversation, no holds barred, between these two very bright and well-traveled and highly opinionated women.
I mean, what struck me about the things that she said and wrote about and with Pearl Buck and with many other women that she came in contact with was, except for some of the more famous women in the literary world or in the political world, like Emma Goldman, who are known because of those activities, what she had to write and say were profound, and they had influence. but we don't think or hear them because women wrote them, because they were put on the shelf. Mm-hmm. Really not put out, pulled out.
Right. And I think, well, one is that even the things that are published are not read as widely as they should
right.
be. The fact that she couldn't get a lot of her writing published also says something about how women, and particularly wives, I mean, I think she was aided by her relationship to Paul, but there may have been ways in which people also looked at her simply as Mrs. Paul Robeson and didn't take her seriously as a writer and a thinker. I also think, you know, we were talking earlier about other women in history, Rosa Parks, for example. We often think of women as symbolic leaders, but not as strategists, as intellectuals. And so someone like Eslander Robeson, who was, you know, an intellectual, a deep thinker, someone who had strong and well-informed opinions, even if they were controversial, about a whole range of issues in the world, we don't look for her voice to tell us about the world. Maybe about women's experience, maybe about Black women's experience,
right.
but not about the world.
Right.
So how, you know, what does it mean to look at the world in the mid-20th century through the lens of this African-American woman? You know, I think it's pretty important.
Yeah, she wrote this I was really taking this in the 40s when she was always profound in her thinking and forthright, but it seemed like in the late 30s, 40s, 50s, she really exploded. I mean, intellectually exploded mm-hmm. in with a fierceness
yeah.
in many ways.
Yeah, well, and, you know, they come back from England in 1939, and in some ways they buy a house in Connecticut, which she sees as partly a writing retreat as much as anything else. And so she does spend a lot of time writing. She's covering the United Nations after 1945. So she's writing about world events there. She develops a group of colleagues and friends through her UN work. And then when their passports are taken in 1950, and you know, from 1950 to 1958, she and Paul both are prohibited from travel because of their communist affiliations. But she writes enormously about the world and what's happening in the world at a time when she herself is not able to actually engage the world in the way that she had before. And in some ways, the 50s are a really prolific time for her. She's meeting people. Despite her illness, she gets diagnosed with cancer. She has 3 bouts of cancer, which she's just really tough and steel-willed and has a lot of grit. And so she's back on her feet after surgery and after treatment. And finally, she does succumb to cancer.
I mean, with this piece in here in 1946 where she people are always talking about the Negro problem. And she writes, "We Negroes believe the problem facing America is not a Negro problem, but a white problem. Only by making America truly democratic will the problem be solved." I mean, she's...
Yeah, and that's 1946.
That's 1946.
Yeah, it's not 1966.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and she comes back from Africa in 1946, and she writes a piece and gives a talk called "Africa is in Revolution."
Right.
Now, the independence revolution had not, you know, come full form at that point, but that was an aspirational statement on her part. So she was pretty bold and pretty brazen in embracing a radical vision of how the world could be, even if it wasn't there yet.
And you mentioned a few moments ago about Paul Robeson and Eslander Robeson losing their passports.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a bit about that and about her. I mean, I never knew of her testimony until your book.
Mm-hmm.
In front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, that went after people.
Mm-hmm.
But she was just so strong. She would not back down from this array of white men in front of her mm-hmm. trying to intimidate her.
Right. Well, HUAC is the more famous of the two main committees during the McCarthy period, the House Un-American Activities Committee. And Paul does later testify before HUAC. Essie actually testifies before Joe McCarthy himself, who, you know, becomes this, you know, sinister figure that personified the witch hunt that went on during those years.
He was Rush Limbaugh with power.
Right. fortunately, his career was short, but in 1953, she was summoned before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the Senate Government Relations Committee. It was a long name. But it was really Joe McCarthy's Senate committee that was rooting out communists, or so he claimed, and subversives and people who he deemed un-American, which was a lot. He had a long list. And she was ostensibly called before the committee because of her 1945 book, African Journey. That book appeared on bookshelves in State Department libraries in other parts of the world, and that was the pretext under which she was summoned. The hearing began by them asking her if she had actually written the book all by herself. And that didn't sit well with the very confident author that she was. So she immediately said, of course, I'm capable of writing a book all by myself. I find that insulting. And went on from there. But basically, she was queried about her affiliations, her beliefs, her husband's beliefs. And she flipped the script in a way and refused to answer certain questions on principle, taking the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination. But she also invoked the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment protects black people's rights to vote, the Reconstruction-era amendment, of course. And they said, well, excuse me, Ms. Rhodes, what are you talking about? You must not understand the constitutional amendments. She said, oh, no, I understand very well. Many of you come from southern states where black people cannot vote, and I do not respect your authority. So she was very defiant and very bold. And unlike some people, she refused to name names. She refused to kind of go along with that very unjust crusade.
And she wrote that piece, I Know a Communist.
Yes. Yes, she wrote a piece called I Know a Communist, and she wrote the foreword to a book in honor of Ben Davis, who was a friend of hers and Paul's, who was a communist, and went to jail for his beliefs. So,
could you pick another piece you want to share with us from the book? At least one other piece, maybe more if we have time.
Okay, let's see. So we were talking a little bit ago about the difficulty of travel in those days, and the 1936 trip that she took to Africa was a difficult trip. But in 1946, she goes to the Belgian Congo and French Equatorial Africa. She goes deep into the interior of the country. She's out of communication with her family for quite a long period of time. She's interviewing people about French colonialism, about Belgian colonialism, and so forth. And she writes a letter to her family that she distributes through a family lawyer. And I'll just read some excerpts from it. She's describing her journey. I have just returned from a very strenuous trip up country. And boy, was it tough going. The French around here told me the trip would be très dur, and when those colonials say hard trip, they really mean a hard trip. I went by car on Tuesday in the morning. I went along with a young administrator and his wife. Instead of sleeping in Grimari and Kembe, as our schedule indicated, we had carburetor trouble and had to sleep in Fort Sibut, the middle of Tsetse Fly area. The country was beautiful and fascinating. The weather was terrific but hot and very heavy. Something I ate disagreed with me, and I was sick the whole time. The rains began, and we never knew whether the roads would be washed out. It was all very nerve-wracking. The night after we arrived at Banguzi, there was a real tornado, which was something. And she goes on. She says, I slept the night in Bambari, saw lots of folks, got lots of material, took lots of pictures. Next day, made my way to Bangui after lots of trouble. Made it finally on Wednesday, July 3rd. I took with me there a bed, mosquito netting, food, and rum. I used the bed and net once, drank all the rum, and didn't use the food at all. People fed me everywhere I went. So she had humor under these very difficult travel conditions. Yeah.
She was both witty and could she be sharp-tongued.
She was sharp-tongued. Sometimes in public, sometimes in her diary, when she didn't think highly of someone, she didn't mince her words in saying so.
When all the travel bans lifted and she's back in America, I was really interested to see the period of time when she was back in Harlem and what she was writing about in terms of, you write about a series of articles she wrote in 63, 64, at the heart of the movement, articles like the Negro Movement, Long Hot Summer, Black Revolution, mm-hmm. and White Backlash, The Time Is Now. Mm-hmm. I mean, her militancy and her growth, and I mean that by one of the things you get from your book is this is a woman who never stopped growing and changing.
Absolutely.
She wasn't fixed.
Yeah, and she wasn't fixed, and she wasn't afraid to change and grow and really embrace new experiences, new ideas, challenge some old ideas. I mean, some ideas were, might have been fixed, but she basically was growing and grappling with a changing world and all of its complexity. She writes a eulogy for Malcolm X after he dies and said in it she didn't agree with everything, but he represented a kind of militancy and a kind of resistance that she much admired.
As you write, fearlessness and militant challenge to American racism.
Right.
That's what you said of Malcolm.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And she admired. She also admired King, who she met in London in the early 1960s. She reached out to Daisy Bates, the leader of the Little Rock, Arkansas struggle, which was 1957. So she really, you know, had her hands on, her finger on the pulse, so to speak, of some of the developments. Even though she lived abroad during that period, after 1958, they go back to London for a number of years. But she's always in communication. She's always a keen, keen observer of what's happening in the world. Her family joked about her having newspapers on the bed. She would had a kind of insatiable desire to consume the news about what was happening in the world and read papers in multiple languages to really absorb as much as she could.
So, and she also had this relationship with the young Lorraine Hansberry.
Yes.
And even helped her helped her pass, helped her die.
Yeah.
Stay with us to the end.
Yeah, she did. She and Paul met Lorraine Hansberry in the early 1950s when Lorraine worked on a journal that Paul had founded called Freedom. And Freedom was an important journal. I could have mentioned it when I talked about Islanda and her commitment to women's rights, because there were some amazing women who worked on that journal. Alice Childress was one, Islanda, Lorraine Hansberry. And
black and white women worked in that journal.
Black and white women.
Right.
But it was a journal that seemed to always have women's issues and women's struggles in the forefront. As I sat in the Tamamit collection at New York University and went through the old microfilm versions of that journal, there were women on the front cover of every issue. There were the women protesting the pass laws in South Africa. There were women domestic workers being featured, women labor organizers, women resisting lynching. So, you know, it was a publication that was very sensitive to women's leadership. And not coincidentally, you know, some very powerful and influential and progressive women were a part of the staff. So, yeah, so Lorraine Hansberry was someone who she developed a relationship with. She visited her as Lorraine was dying, of course. She died very young and very tragically. Lorraine Hansberry, of course, being the playwright for, you know, who wrote A Raisin in the Sun,
right.
It was on Broadway. But she was there a short time before Lorraine died and comforted her mother and comforted her.
That's why I said she seemed to be everywhere. And
she had an amazing coterie of friends and relations and surrounded herself with some amazing people.
So tell me, I'm curious. I mean, you discover this person and then you delve into her life so deeply, and she and Paul Robeson's life, but not just their lives, but it was the period, this very... a period of a huge artistic explosion in the black world, revolutionary period that they occupied such space in. For you, I read your epilogue, but for you, what came out of this?
Mm-hmm.
What did she say to you, to us now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a few things. And one is kind of going back to where we started with her internationalism. I think my own political activity, I'm an activist as well as a writer and a historian. You know, I really think the importance of global solidarity work is can't be overstated. And the fact that someone engaged in that work as a matter of principle and a matter of her own vision and her own identity really was a global citizen is such an important lesson for today, when we are so quickly retreating to nationalism and very narrow notions of who our people are and you know, and what we are a citizen of. Right. So I think that's an important lesson. Her resilience and her uncompromising ability to stand up for what she believed, even when it was costly. I mean, they lost their passports. They also lost their home and much of their income as a result of the McCarthy period. And I think that, you know, sometimes people are very pragmatic and very opportunist about politics in difficult times. And mm-hmm. So I think today she is an important inspiration for all of us. And I think that the lesson and legacy of black women's leadership is in her story as well, which we don't often hold up and don't often see in the way that we should.
And the importance of that, I mean, because you represent that yourself. I mean, that's something you believe in very deeply. You feel it.
Mm-hmm.
You've been in the movement. You're a fighter for social justice besides being a professor, as you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in some ways, and it's not, you know, we talk in academia about essentialism. I mean, I'm not saying that because black women activists with our black women, that they somehow represent a more progressive view. But I think to the extent that a set of politics embrace the collective experience and the common experience of black women in the world and in this country, we get at a whole range of injustices that have to be addressed if those voices are at the center. Sexism, homophobia, poverty, imperialism. I mean, all of these things that black women from Rwanda to South Africa to the south side of Chicago experience and navigate with their families and their children, you know, are at the center of what I see as a black feminist vision. And even though neither Ella Baker nor Essie Robeson define themselves as black feminists, I see them very much as a part of that holistic tradition of addressing multiple oppressions and really striving for and fighting for a different kind of world for not just black people, but everybody.
Because, you know, both their lives, I mean, there's women who are in the middle of the labor struggles, in the middle of struggles of civil rights. They're embedded in the struggle for black liberation, but it goes way beyond that for them both.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things I worked on after the Ella Baker book was a network of women artists, activists, and scholars who were working in Ella Baker's tradition. We called it Ella's Daughters. And the practice that we tried to embrace was, we called it political quilting, which is unlike coalition building, which can be very pragmatic and very temporary and transient. The idea of really trying to embed an analysis in understanding not only what you're suffering, but what someone else is suffering who might speak a different language, have a different culture, who came into politics through a different route. So really trying to see some of the interconnections between different forms of injustice and oppression, and hence build a quilt that is a resistance movement and a freedom movement that could be truly liberatory on many levels.
And where's that gone?
Well, it still exists. I had to abandon my role in it for a little while I was finishing the Islanda Robeson book. But there was and is a really amazing network of young women in particular who have we do a monologue about Ella Baker's life. We do workshops around Ella Baker's tradition and really try to reach out across different boundaries. So it continues to exist, and I hope to get back to it.
That's just amazing. This book is amazing. I just want to thank you for writing it.
Thank you for reading it.
I was consumed by it.
Well, you know, when you're working on a project for a very long time, you know, the great hope is that this will matter to somebody other than me. So I'm always grateful when people appreciate it.
Well, it does. And I would encourage everyone to read this book, Eslanda, 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 The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. An amazing human being, an inspiration to all of us, somebody who is not just beautiful but brilliant, and a revolutionary thinker and an artist and a writer, and stood up for what was right, and through cancer and all of her pain and illness, never stopped.
Mm-hmm. Fighter to the end.
Fighter to the end. Barbara Ransby, it's been just an honor and a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Martin.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. To hear the show again and podcast any of our past shows and find out information about our guests, the work they do, what they've been writing, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. This is Mark Steiner. Please join the Daily Record and me for the 11th Annual Annapolis Summit on January the 8th, 2014, from 7 to 10 a.m. at the Governor Calvert House, where I'll interview Governor Martin O'Malley, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Mike Bush on the opening day of the legislative session. It's your chance to have your voice heard. Tickets at 443-524-8101 or claire.sheehan@thedailyrecord.com. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, and WEAA.